This is a tremendous gift. It's why meditation isn't merely a relaxation break followed by a return to the same old, same old. If we keep falling back into habitual fear or anger, even when we know it's unreasonable, it can be because the deep, persistent imprints of past traumas override rationality. Now that we're clearing the imprints out of our system, we're beginning to find the open space for a life of freedom. It's very important to understand this. Otherwise, we could think, hey, I started meditating to relax, not to twitch or feel anxious. It's as if sometime in the past a pile of dirt was swept under our rug. Now the cleaning crew has arrived. While they're doing their work, we might think, wait, the room was nice and clean, but now I'm seeing all this dirt. That's temporary. If we let the cleaning continue, soon the dirt will be swept away and the room will be truly clean. Some of this cleaning happens every time we sit and rest as awareness. Usually very quietly, subtly, without any noticeable moods or sensations or movements, but sometimes with them. It defies analysis. It's impossible and unnecessary to know exactly which trauma is being flushed out when. But if, say, you suddenly feel a wave of hot or cold or restlessness or fear, don't decide that meditation has stopped working and it's time to bail. It has started really working. Occasionally, the moods and associated thoughts that are kicked up may be so intense that they seem to overwhelm your attention. In that case, easily scan your body from the inside and note the physical aspect of the feeling. Perhaps pressure in the head, butterflies in the stomach, tightness in the chest, which may have gone unnoticed till now. The cascade of moods and thoughts will probably continue in the background for a while, but rather than focusing on them, just go on resting your attention on the physical sensations until, in their own time, they ease up. Unlike moods and thoughts, sensations are just sensations, neutral phenomena like changing weather. So this tactic facilitates the smooth release of the old imprints, while psychologically you take a breather in a neutral corner. My old teacher, the late Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, used to insist that all his students should appreciate this process. In my 20s, I attended as many long retreats with him as I could, whether in the mountains of Colorado or Switzerland, or in off-season beach hotels on the island of Mallorca, sometimes meditating for many hours a day for months at a stretch. Don't try this at home. In such a setting, with hundreds of people aboard, we would hear reports in our evening meetings from retreatants going through some very intense catharses, reliving old physical injuries or emotional crises, laughing, crying, sometimes feeling like they were going to sock someone or their heads were going to explode. Maharishi would patiently field all the reports, reminding us again and again that these experiences were just temporary symptoms of neurological clearing. He would chuckle and repeat, like the refrain of a song, "Something good is happening." And he was right. My whole subsequent life has taken place in the sparkling open space cleared out on those retreats. Don't worry about doing it right. You can't do this right. You also can't do it wrong. You can't do it at all. It does you. Worrying about doing it right is like worrying about whether you're paddling your little canoe the right way as the white water sweeps you downstream. This is not about cultivating a skill. It's about shrugging your shoulders and giving up all notions of skillfulness. What a relief. Here's another way to look at it. You might have noticed that it's never any time other than the present moment. Check and see. And it's always too late to change the present moment. It's already here, and it's already however it is. So you may as well give up. Just rest in awareness, as it is, now. Marinate in it, bask in it, what else can you do? Your only other choice is to bang your head against it, like an animal banging its head against the bars of its cage. We know how to do that, whether feebly or fiercely, we've all tried it. Now, instead, for a few minutes a day, choose basking over banging, and see what happens. Every moment you spend resting in this space of giving up is a moment giving the sympathetic nervous system a break and allowing the parasympathetic system to kick in. That is, it's a moment spent unlearning the cranked-up fight-or-flight state and replacing it with the stay-and-play state, the subside-and-abide state. It's a moment of unconditioning from your old, habitual, how do I fix this hypervigilance, and relaxing into, if it ain't broke, serenity. Don't worry about what other people tell you. Good-hearted, well-meaning friends may tell you that to really meditate, you have to sit motionless for an hour, concentrate on X or Y object, kill your thoughts, press your tongue against your palate, or whatever. If you find some tip to be consistent with effortless, natural resting, then fine. But otherwise, feel free to nod, smile, thank your friends for their kind advice, then go on your way and forget about it. A stroll in the park. Just think of meditation as less like shoveling coal and more like taking a stroll in the park. How long will you walk? Someone timing you with a stopwatch might report afterward that it was 5 minutes or 15 minutes or 30 minutes. But you have no stopwatch. You just get lost in the experience. If a dog barks in the distance, you don't complain about it spoiling your concentration. If a passerby says hello, or if you have to scratch your elbow or blow your nose, you don't fret about that taking you out of it. You don't concern yourself with whether the experience is as deep or as good as your previous strolls in the park, or the strolls in the park that other people are taking, or the ones you've read about in books. You certainly don't worry about whether you're good at strolling in the park or doing it right or making progress. You just take a stroll in the park. Part 3. Overdrive. Hyperspace. Chapter 13. Take a little walk with me. When my kids were young, I had an old dark green Volvo. With its square, heavy body, it was built for safety, not for speed. But on the dashboard, there was a button marked Overdrive. You were only supposed to push it when your engine was winding out in fourth gear to lower the RPMs for a quieter, more relaxed, more fuel-efficient ride. But my son, Day, was fascinated with two things, cars and Star Wars, and he somehow managed to conflate the Overdrive button with the hyperspace control on the Millennium Falcon. As soon as we got buckled up and hit the road, he would start urging me, "Put it in overdrive! Put it in overdrive, Pop!" hoping to see the headlights on the Garden State Parkway suddenly draw back like the radiating streams of starlight as Han Solo jumps his craft to light speed. You now have your craft, the vehicle that will bring you to the dimension beyond fear, natural meditation. If you just keep your foot on the gas, keep sitting down for a few minutes a day, there's no reason it shouldn't get you there, as it has so many before you. But sometimes you may want to goose things along, to punch some overdrive button or other, to make your ride faster or smoother or just more fun. There are many such buttons, auxiliary methods. Most are simple, some more elaborate. Some are done sitting with eyes closed, some when you're in the thick of things, at your parents' sickbed, or as you confront the other driver's road rage, or your own. or as your friend offers you the drink or the joint that you know will send your life careening over the rails again. These methods can make use of any aspect of your life, from your posture to your sleep to your voice. They're all effective and all optional. And sometimes, when things are lined up right, they'll take you into hyperspace. So, as you read this section, keep an open, playful, experimental attitude. The best method is the one you'll actually do. So try the ones that somehow talk to you, and know that next week or next month, different ones may talk to you. Eventually, you can make up your own. George Carlin used to do a stand-up routine about driving that I think applies here, and just about everywhere else, actually. Fuck it. You paid for the car. Use everything. Use the sun visor, even on a cloudy day. Flip it up. Flip it down. Flip it over to the side like the French people do. Lower the passenger's visor, even if no one is sitting there. Open the ashtray. Push in the lighter. Who cares if you don't smoke? Turn all the knobs. Press all the buttons. Have a lot of fun. Change the mirrors all around. Press the trunk release. Pop the hood open. Put your seat in a ridiculous position. Walk this way. If I were a psychotherapist, which I most assuredly am not, I think I wouldn't sit in a room, letting my clients talk, stuck in one position while their problems, or perceived problems, ricocheted again and again off the four walls. I would walk with them in the open air, where our forward motion and freedom of movement through space could model forward motion and freedom of movement through life. Together we would take in whatever sights, sounds, and chance encounters happened our way, welcoming the continual incursion of the larger world which rolls on and on, of which the client's problem would be seen as one part. In that context, I would let them talk, if they still wanted to. Whether with a therapist or with a simpatico friend or on your own, consider taking your fear, your anxiety, or whatever your issue is, for a walk. In addition to putting your situation in a bigger, less self-concerned context, a 2016 study found that a 5-minute walking break once an hour made office workers feel happier and more energetic, with fewer food cravings. Nietzsche said, "All truly great thoughts are conceived by walking." And many writers, artists, inventors, and other creative types have long found that that's when they get their most out-of-left-field inspirations. Recent studies at Stanford University have confirmed this belief. Students assigned a creative task, such as generating as many innovative uses as possible for a common object, scored from 81 to 100% better while walking than while sitting. Not surprisingly, many forward-looking companies, including Apple, Facebook, and Oracle, have started using walking instead of office sit-downs for meetings of 2 or 3 people. Research has shown that greater creativity and focus result from a relaxed, collegial, side-by-side stroll. And one of the best things you can do for your marriage or relationship is to walk together as often as possible, side-by-side, literally seeing things the same way, letting the flow of shared thoughts, feelings, concerns, jokes, and silence be easygoing and spontaneous. For centuries, walking has been an essential method of the sages. Socrates roamed the sunny streets of Athens with his young followers in tow, stopping here and there to engage the big shots of his day in penetrating dialogues that would deconstruct their bigness. Jesus roamed from town to town with his disciples, as did the Buddha, as did Adi Shankara. Generally, the records tell us what they said when they arrived and the locals gathered for a teaching, but not what they said to their closest students on the road. We can imagine that they often strode along in perfectly contented silence, just walking, enjoying the journey, perhaps throwing out an occasional comment or gesture, subtly facilitating their students' ability to join them in the depths of their own beingness. And we can imagine that sometimes students would air their questions, doubts, fears, and unresolved traumas, and the sages would respond with a spontaneity and intimacy and humor which the transcripts that later became scriptures failed to capture. You had to be there. This rather lofty scenario has a straightforward neurophysiological basis. Walking is a cross-lateral movement. As you step with your left leg, your right arm automatically swings forward along with it, and vice versa. Any cross-lateral movement engages both the left and right cerebral hemispheres in coordinated activity, their neurons firing synchronously. This has a rejuvenating effect on brain function, mobilizing and integrating the analytic faculties associated with the left hemisphere and the intuitive faculties of the right, priming the whole brain for fresh ways of seeing and understanding. Our first cross-lateral movement is crawling, which helps prime the brain for the infant's dramatic period of rapid learning. In fact, a recharging mental palate cleansing technique that you may find useful, especially when you're engaged in long periods of study or work at a computer, is a kind of hyperwalking that you can do without leaving the room. It exaggerates the cross-lateral movement to the point of midline crossing, which further enhances the neurological benefits. Standing in one spot, lift your left knee and touch it with your right hand. Return to the starting position, then lift your right knee and touch it with your left hand. Continue to alternate, stepping in place or marching around the room. And to add a more invigorating cardio workout, touch the opposite foot instead of the knee. You can see photos of these walking techniques on the Fear Less page of my website, deanwords.com. For a full-on, hilariously exaggerated version of this exercise, bring your knee as high as you can and across the body's midline. Meanwhile, swing the opposite hand diagonally in front of your torso and past your ear. I don't think Socrates did this, but it's fun to imagine. This is a great nervous system warm-up and clear-out, just before, say, taking an exam, negotiating a deal, competing in a sport, or coming on stage to perform. You'll enter the fray with a sharp but relaxed confidence, not because you or your teacher or coach has pep-talked you into some whipped-up belief that you can succeed, but because you're objectively, neurologically wired to succeed. Walking, incidentally, has a host of additional documented benefits. That shouldn't be a surprise. Obviously, we're built to walk, and until about 15 minutes ago in evolutionary time, we all did plenty of it. Walking has been shown to enhance T-cell production and other markers of immune system health. It aids weight loss, boosts blood glucose control, and lowers blood pressure and triglyceride levels, especially when done right after meals. If you do it in the daytime, the exposure to sunlight helps prevent nearsightedness. Walking can ease depression, and, as indicated by reduced cortisol levels, it lowers stress. That's dry clinical language, but it points us back to the juicy reality of the kingdom of heaven within, and the sages who walk there. Walking, like sitting, can be meditation, a way of waking up to delicious, empty, open awareness. Increased synchronous activity of the cerebral hemispheres also happens to be a symptom of meditative states. It's literally getting your head together. There are venerable traditions of walking meditation, going back at least 2,500 years to the time of the Buddha. In fact, in the Anapanasati Sutta, walking is the first position the Buddha lists for meditation, followed by sitting, standing, and lying down. When I visited Lumbini, the birthplace of the Buddha, I spent time with some monks who practice extremely slow, deliberate walking meditation, taking several minutes to mindfully complete each step. Given all the millions of mindless steps we take in a lifetime, that's a useful exercise to try at least once, paying microscopic attention to the amazingly rich nuances and the sequence of uncountable sub-actions and sub-sub-actions contained in a single step. Some people, watching the monks do this kind of slow walking, might say, "Wow, they must be in some kind of trance." But it's us who are usually in a trance, so hypnotized by our thoughts that we miss the simple, immediate reality of actual experience. Our scenarios of fear and craving are indeed scenarios, little scenes, playing out in the theater of the mind. Every moment we spend paying attention to our feet touching the ground is a moment spent breaking out of our trance. This super slow walking might become a regular part of your meditative practice for a little while, or a long while, or it might be something to return to as needed when things get crazy, or it might not speak to you at all. But even when you're fast walking down a city street, phone in hand, hurrying from point A to point B, you can rest as awareness and know that the passing sights and sounds are just the stuff you're aware of, like the passing thoughts and sensations during sitting meditation. What is the silence through which everything frictionlessly passes? It's you, the very awareness in which the question resonates. Rest as that. When I walk this way, I sometimes hear the words of the old blues man, Robert Lockwood Jr., in his song, "Take a Little Walk with Me." He sings about longing and about getting back to the same old place. We're walking back to the same old transcendent place where the sages walked, back beyond trouble and fear, where all the trembling beings long to be, even when they think they're longing for the next dollar or donut or spliff or screw, longing for happiness, safety, peace. It's the same old place where we've always been, but have, till now, somehow fail to recognize. How can we arrive where we already are? The song tells us that, too. Come on, baby. To enter into the kingdom of heaven, be like a baby, a little child, a tabula rasa, without plan or concept. Then there's not much to do. Just take a little walk, sing a little song, sit a little while. Take any road, but take it easy. It's so simple, closer than close, which is precisely why we keep overlooking it. It's where you are now, at this step, and now at this step. Walking, sitting, standing, lying down. Just rest in it, right here. Chapter 14. Drop Your Thoughts. Our next overdrive method is dramatically effective and stupid simple. For some people, it becomes the method. You can use it anytime, anywhere. It works in all kinds of situations by taking a principle of eyes closed meditation and applying it to the eyes open world. Drop your thoughts. You can do this right now. Just put your hands in front of your face, clap them together once sharply, and drop your thoughts. Ready, go. That's it. As in meditation, dropping your thoughts doesn't mean trying to push them away or block them out. Just relax your grip on them, and it doesn't matter whether they continue. They're like some blah, blah, blah commercial playing on your TV in the living room when you've gone off to the kitchen to grab a drink. They're like the buzz, buzz, buzz of a conversation a dozen yards away at the airport, between people speaking a language you can't even identify. They're just there. Don't bother about them. Don't try to drop the thoughts forever. Just drop them for right now, say 5 seconds worth of right now, and then you're done. The moment you relax your grip on the thoughts, their power over you deflates. Remember our experiment with the ball, first walking around gripping it tight and then relaxing our grip. We saw that it doesn't matter whether the ball remains in our hand or rolls off. Our hand is now open to the sky, and the ball's presence or absence makes no difference. Of course, in meditation, it's a little easier to write off thoughts. You may get caught up in an extended fantasy about your upcoming vacation, and then it's as if you're there, strolling along the tranquil white beaches of Puerto Vallarta. or you get caught up in an extended rehash of that argument you had with your partner or parent or child, and that becomes your reality. But then you realize, no, these are just thoughts. I'm just sitting here with my eyes closed. This is nothing but blah, blah. And once again, you relax your grip and sink back into yourself, into simple awareness. It's fine that this happens. In fact, you have to experience getting caught up so you can experience letting go. You have to know clenching to definitively know unclenching. Getting caught, then letting go, then getting caught, then letting go. That's how we ultimately stop getting caught. We finally get de-snagged, neurologically rewired to process thoughts with a non-stick mind. Then we preemptively recognize thoughts as just thoughts and are free of them even as they show up. Being free doesn't mean getting rid. If you have to get rid of something, you're not really free. But now we're not just sitting with our eyes closed, wandering off into dreamy little reveries. Now we're in the world. Now our thoughts are real. Well, are they now? Are our thoughts a clear window onto the outside world? Or are they more like graffiti spray-painted on the window? Hey, look, there's the first robin of spring, hopping around the lawn in the morning dew, grazing for its breakfast. How adorable, how delightful, how springtime poetic, how evocative of our nursery rhymes and picture books about Robin Redbreast. Unless you happen to be a worm. Then the robin is a terrifying monster. Cue the Jaws theme. David Lynch brilliantly conveys this robin as monster vision in Blue Velvet. On the other hand, a crocodile is a terrifying monster, unless you're a baby croc and then it's mom. So these qualities of being adorable or terrifying are not absolute, not inherent in the object. They're our graffitied-on thoughts. For practical purposes, of course, we need to know that robins are harmless, to us, but to steer clear of crocs. Many thoughts, though, instead of helping us judge accurately, can stoke our fears and actually bring more danger into the world. Persistent fears are fed by set ideas. We've seen political bedlam and actual deaths result from set ideas along the lines of Westerner equals Great Satan, or brown skin equals Muslim equals terrorist. We've seen police shootings arise from the idea that black male equals big and scary. A recent study by the American Psychological Association found that subjects viewing photographs of black men and white men of identical height and weight thought the black men were taller, heavier, and more muscular than the white men. And the more stereotypically black the men's features were, the more pronounced this bias was, whether the subject viewing the photos was black or white. And white subjects judged the black men as more threatening. To find a contrasting, unbiased, idyllic innocence, we can look to 19th century New England and the woods of Walden Pond, where Henry David Thoreau lived in his hand-built cabin and became nature's first great nature writer. As John Cage later wrote, "Thoreau got up each morning and walked to the woods as though he had never been where he was going to, so that whatever was there came to him like liquid into an empty glass. Many people taking such a walk would have had their heads so full of other ideas that it would be a long time before they were capable of hearing or seeing. Most people are blinded by themselves." We can't all live in the woods, but we can all do this. Be like an empty glass into which experience is poured. Stop being blinded by ourselves, by our thoughts more precisely, and hear and see with sublime clarity. It doesn't matter how many thoughts have been poured into the glass over how many years. It only takes a moment to turn it over and empty it. Just clap your hands in front of your face and drop your thoughts. Disengage from them. It's true that a few moments later they start re-engaging, but every time we drop them, we weaken their power and strengthen our clear vision. In one chapter of Walden, Thoreau lists all the different colors of winter ice on different parts of Walden Pond. I had always thought that ice was white. The key word is thought. Name-dropping. One of the ways we maintain our set ideas is through naming. Different names for the same thing can make you feel differently about it. That's why there are dozens of lawyer jokes, but no attorney jokes. Depending on what they want you to think and feel, politicians will talk about undocumented immigrants or illegal aliens, terrorists or freedom fighters, the estate tax or the death tax. Republicans routinely refer to the Democrat Party, which sounds like something that lives in the sewer. And of course, this kind of manipulation is what advertisers do for a living. Car commercials used to reel off the exciting features of the latest model, including rack and pinion steering. It turns out that all cars have rack and pinion steering. It just sounds cool, especially when growled by a macho voiceover artist. But even more important to see, and see through, is how we manipulate our own attitudes with names. A friend of mine was born with one leg a few inches shorter than the other, and whenever he talked about it, he called it his deformity. I suggested that he try using the less loaded word anomaly instead. And that simple shift helped him to see how he had made his leg the focal point for feelings of guilt, shame, and inadequacy. William Blake called these attitudes mind-forged manacles. Because they're forged by the mind, made completely out of thoughts, they have no substance. Once we see what they are, they can no longer hold us. But we have to see them. Try referring to your parents by their first names instead of calling them Mom and Dad. That can help you see that they are, or were, just people with their own lives, their own dreams and frustrations, their own virtues and limitations. They're neither gods for you to live up to, nor dragons for you to slay, nor problems for you to make a lifelong hobby of sorting through with your therapist. They exist on their own, not just as characters in your drama, the hero's parents. To other people, they were a son or daughter, a brother or sister, a vague neighbor without any name at all. The less it's all your drama, with its claustrophobic plot and tedious themes, the more relief, the more freedom. Believing is seeing. If we return to the same thought enough times, it becomes a belief. Each time we revisit it, it seems more familiar, more apparently substantial and permanent, more as if it's part of the reality outside our heads. Once, during my school teaching days, I was sitting in the cafeteria at lunchtime with four or five colleagues. I got up from the table to get some dessert and returned with a big square piece of chocolate cake slathered on top with that great gooey artificial flavor-laden cafeteria chocolate frosting. Suzanne, a fellow English teacher, blurted out, "Dean, you don't eat that stuff." I considered for a moment, then replied, "Well, evidently I do." It seems that her concept of who I was, a strict, health-conscious, pure-food-only type, and God knows what else, had collided with the actuality before her eyes, and she chose to go with the concept. "It's my story, and I'm sticking to it." That's our mantra. When it's applied to less benign matters than cake, matters such as race, religion, and that tribe at the other end of the valley that grunts in a different language from ours, it explains a lot of wretched human history. We think we're terrified of people or furious with them, when what actually terrifies or infuriates us may just be our own thoughts. Then we start giving the other tribe the skunk eye and sharpening our spears, which confirms their worst thoughts about us, and soon everyone's biases become self-fulfilling prophecies. Kaboom! The irony is that, even when we regard a belief as solid and permanent, it's actually absent more than it's present. Because our beliefs contain no ingredients other than reiterated thoughts, they're gluten-free, they exist only when we think them. When you're in the state of dreamless sleep, what's your religion? In mid-orgasm, are you a Democrat or a Republican? All your doctrines and ideologies vanish when you sneeze, or focus on your income taxes, or lose yourself in a movie, or a novel, or a kiss. This is why we need such engrossing diversions. If you could really succeed in being a good 100% Muslim, or Christian, or socialist, or libertarian, or anything else for 24 straight hours, your head would probably explode. Of course, we don't realize that our doctrines evaporate every time we stop thinking them, because when they come back, they include the thought, "This has been here all this time." Nice trick. It's a built-in backstory. But it's still just a story. So no one has to teach you how to drop thoughts. You've already done it hundreds of times today. Every time you turn to another object of attention, whether it's the breakfast menu or the ringing of your phone or that inaccessible itch between your shoulder blades, you've dropped your other thoughts. All we're doing now is dropping them all, consciously and deliberately, and turning, instead of to another object of attention, to nothing in particular. Not realizing they already know how to drop their thoughts, people go to great lengths to relieve themselves of that pressure. When I walk past a club on a Saturday night, see all those loaded people on the sidewalk, hear the pounding music, it sure looks like they're trying to blow away their thinking. They have the right idea, but their method is a tad heavy-handed. It reeks a lot of wear and tear. When you discover how easy it is to just drop your thoughts, you don't have to wait for Saturday night, and you can do it with a feather instead of a jackhammer. Just drop your thoughts. Boom. Done. Disengaged. A few seconds later, you're probably engaged again, but now the thoughts hold on you is a little weaker, because you've punched one more little hole in their illusion of permanence. Perfect. There are many ways to click unsubscribe. You can smack your hands together in front of your face, or a bit more gently, snap your fingers, or in the middle of your mental monologue, suddenly exclaim, "Hey!" and look up at the sky. See if you can surprise yourself. You can sigh or exhale deeply, or douse yourself with cold water. More about this one in a later chapter. Or stick a post-it message on your bathroom mirror or your computer screen saying, "Drop your thoughts." Or in the middle of a thought fest, suddenly put your attention in the place of non-thought that you inhabit when you sneeze or sleep. It's always available. Or imagine that you win a free vacation on a paradise island. Whee! But you've packed all your old thoughts in your suitcase, and the airline loses it. Bye-bye. One way or another, do it again and again throughout the day. Then, when things get serious and you need to drop your thoughts to save your sanity, it's a reflex. You can find the unsubscribe button in the dark. Eventually, even the thought of dropping your thoughts can be dropped. They're always there when you need them to work with or want them to play with, but they no longer suffocate you. There's more space between your thoughts, and more space within them. They're less like cold, congealed bacon fat, more like meringue. You're less weighed down by whatever stories you've been dragging around. Then your interactions with others become less squeezed and distorted, clearer, more straightforward, with more room to be intelligent and kind. Freed from our old, self-constructed, claustrophobic labyrinths, we meet in open space. The question. Here comes a question to ask yourself. Don't try to think up an answer. Just close your eyes, ask the question, and see what bubbles up. The very first thing that pops up, before your mind gets in the way, may be the deep truth you need to hear. If so, make note of that right away. Maybe write it down. Don't feed it to your mind, which will try to analyze it, rationalize it, soften it. Ready? Go. What are the underlying beliefs that fuel your fear, anxiety, anger, or addiction? If you got some surprising news just now, you may want to digest it for a little while. To spur further exploration, here are answers that some people find when they do this exercise. I'm the good child, and I'm responsible for everyone. I'm the bad child, and will disappoint everyone. Sooner or later, people always let me down. I must be intimidating. I must be desirable. I have to be my father or mother. I have to reject my father or mother. There's a catch. It's every man for himself. Those were the good old days. Men are, fill in the blank. Women are, fill in the blank. No one can tell me what to do. I deserve more. I deserve less. It's never okay to be alone. If I let my guard down, someone will hurt me. I don't get to sit at the cool kid's table. If I'm cynical, I'll be safe. Life is so unfair. Life is so confusing. Life is so predictable. Being happy is so difficult. Recognizing such beliefs, and recognizing that they are beliefs, habitually reiterated thoughts masquerading as permanent objective realities, is a big first step. Then, even if, for now, they're still there, it's easier to see through them to the free, open space on the other side. When they come up, you can clap your hands and drop them for 5 seconds. They'll probably still hang around, but because you've disengaged from them, even momentarily, their claws have disengaged from you. Anytime you drop any thoughts, you're becoming less susceptible to the spell of all thoughts, including these. There are a lot of nebbishy loser beliefs on our list, and these are obviously a burden, but what about the quasi-heroic ones? The record shows I took the blows and did it my way. Oy, that can be a lot of work for you and the people around you. But as always, don't take my word for it. Experiment. If you've lived your whole life with some belief, try living without it 5 seconds at a time. Or if, say, you believe I have to be my mother, for 1 week, assume that you don't. And then see if your life is more sane and graceful with your old belief or without it. Beliefs are a lot of dead weight compared to the lighter-than-air weightlessness of just being, which is always instantly available the moment you drop your thoughts. Why keep hauling that big bag of manure? Where are you hauling it? When do you get to redeem it, and for what? If you feel resistance to dropping these thoughts, that's normal. That's a measure of how identified you are with them. How much, deep down, it feels as if you'll disappear if they're taken away. But by the same token, it's a measure of how much more free and spacious you'll be without them. Meanwhile, don't panic. It's only for 5 seconds, and then you can have them back. And they'll come back, wagging their tails behind them. May your biggest problem be that you get stuck in freedom. Often these things are easier to see in others. Observe your friends. Use your X-ray vision. What are their underlying beliefs? And how are those working out for them? Take a walk. Look around at people. See the ones who look happy in a sustainable way, not just riding a momentary whooshing thrill coaster. And see the ones who look conflicted and jammed up within themselves. You can see it if you pay attention. Which ones are stuffed with beliefs and which ones are full of open space? And if you're really ready to rock and roll, try this. What if everything you think about everything is complete bullshit. What if for 5 seconds, or maybe 5 minutes, you can just assume that? All the stuff you think you've figured out about life, politics, diet, music, religion, your so-called self, all of it, utter bullshit. When you take a break from having to believe it's all true all the time, can you feel by contrast what a strain it's been to maintain? Can you feel how infinitely refreshing it is to just drop it all? Extending the experiment. There's been a lot of talk lately about men who mansplain things to women with an excess of self-confidence, or at least an excess of bluster, posing as self-confidence. Maybe the deeper problem is that, regardless of gender, we all mansplain things to ourselves. The blustering, assertive part of our mind bullies the gentler, more open part. So perhaps we could extend this dropping of thoughts into some experiments in non-explanation. Look at a work of art that puzzles you. Actually, it can't puzzle you. It's just sitting there, being perfectly whatever it is, while you scratch your head and puzzle at it, hurling thoughts at it and trying to get some to stick. Like life, it's only confusing when you think about it. Try dropping all your thoughts about what the object means and let it just be. And then feel how that gives you space to just be. Then try doing the same thing with that greatest of unexplainables, another person. Look into your partner's eyes, or a close friend or colleague's. Notice all the thoughts about him or her that come up, and drop them, again and again. For once, let the other person just be. And feel the space open up for you to just be. If you're in a marriage or a relationship, with continued exploration, you'll start finding moments to drop together into this thought-free space, peppering your days and nights with them. More and more, you'll find yourselves just being together, together in the wide open space of just being. Do this with your friends. Do it with your turtle or fish and the tree across the street. Eventually, extend this space to all beings. Perhaps the most fundamental crime, which makes all other crimes possible, is to reduce others to concepts, to squeeze the gorgeous, sprawling complexity of those living, breathing beings into the straitjacket of my thoughts about them. How tragic to spend all those years with fellow beings who are alive and real behind their eyes just as we are, and see not them but our own stale thoughts. How much less interesting, how much more dangerous. Imagine what your life would be like if everyone you know, all your friends and relatives and colleagues, dropped their thoughts a few times a day. Wouldn't their lives be better? Wouldn't yours? Imagine if everyone in the world did it. Wouldn't the world be better? Well, there's one little piece of that world that you can do something about. Gotta start somewhere. Eventually, when you feel fairly at home with this practice, look at the thing that scares you. The closed window if you're claustrophobic, or the spider if you're arachnophobic, and drop your thoughts about it. As you did with your partner, let the spider just be. If you have the thought, but I'm still shaking, my visceral response has not gone away, fine, that's another thought. Relax your grip on it, drop it, and let the visceral response be whatever it is. If rage is your thing, look at the person who enrages you. Maybe that's a matter of closing your eyes and visualizing the a-hole in the white Beamer who tailgated you on the way to work this morning. If it's someone in politics, get his image up on your phone or computer screen. Look into his eyes. See all your thoughts come up about how badly he sucks, and then drop them. See them come up again. Relax your grip. Drop them. Drop them. But don't let that stop you from voting, donating, and marching against him. We're just putting the Zen in citizen. Meanwhile, you've been sitting in meditation, ideally every day. If the approach we've been exploring in this chapter is like scrubbing thoughts loose from the mind, as when you scrub burned rice from the bottom of a pot, then meditation is like letting the pot soak in sudsy water so all the burned grains can gently loosen up. Together, the two approaches will get the thing clean. As you move on in your life, cooking up new dishes, they don't need to be tainted by the old dregs. I once interviewed Wolfgang Puck, the famous chef, and I asked him the secret of great cooking. He said, "Start with the best ingredients and then don't screw them up." No matter what your background, no matter what your circumstances, God or life or the universe has given you the very best ingredients, a human mind and body, capable of navigating through this amazing world full of fellow beings, and capable of opening to boundless okayness, perfect, simple peace. And even if you think you've screwed it all up, well, that also is a thought. Smack your hands together and drop it. What's left? Here we are. Chapter 15. The Fire Hose. Sometimes we feel like we need to take a shower on the inside. It may be a passing thing, for a day, a moment, or it may be some ongoing life situation. But something needs to be cleaned out. We might feel as if whatever's at the base of our fear, anger, or addiction has such a stubborn presence within us that it really is stuff, an internal substance, a thick, gooey, sticky sludge, and we need some kind of powerful fire hose to flush it out. The Tibetans have a particularly wide array of specialized meditative tools, including a fire hose called the Vajrasattva practice. The name Vajrasattva can be translated as thunderbolt being, and the practice does clean folks out with the brilliant luminosity and awesome power of a thunderbolt. Traditionally, it's used for clearing out the karmic residues of past wrongdoing, as well as the deep roots of physical illness, negative feelings, personal demons, or anything else that might be gumming up our consciousness, what Buddhists call emotional defilements and obscurations to enlightenment. Most of the men I work with in prison love this practice. They understand the need for it. One winter, after I'd been working with my group at Northern State for a year or two, we decided to tackle the most elaborate version of Vajrasattva practice, which requires learning 100-syllable mantra in Tibetan. One of the most inspiring teaching experiences I've ever had was sitting in the cold cinder block chapel with my guys, some of whom had never completed grade school and could barely read English, all working diligently to memorize the mantra as I recited each word and they recited it back, gradually stringing it all together, syllable by syllable, line by line. But let's start with a more accessible, entry-level version. Sit comfortably, close your eyes, and consider what defilement or obscuration you want to work with. Obscurations are any emotions that block your clear view of the infinite okayness of existence, including fear, anger, anxiety, or any other emotion that makes life seem not okay. Defilements are anything with which we feel we've polluted ourselves. Broken promises, actions that have caused suffering to ourselves or others, sins, to use a highly loaded word, and self-destructive habits, including addictions. If you feel there's a demon, whatever that might mean to you, at the root of your addiction or of any problem, then that's an emotional reality for you, and you can approach it in those terms. In a given session, you can focus on purifying one specific thing, or all of them in a general way. Next, consider what role you may have played in creating the obscuration or defilement, or inviting the demon, and commit yourself to stopping doing it. This is crucial. The traditional teaching is that if you truly, sincerely make that commitment, there's nothing that can't be purified. Next, consider the fact that innumerable others have suffered from the same thing as you, even though their circumstances may have been quite different. Deeply consider this. How many men have abused their wives or partners? How many people have felt enslaved by a drug? How many have realized the horror of having done terrible damage to another that can never be undone? Whatever it is, know that you're not alone in this. And then entertain the wish that, through the practice you're about to undertake, not only you, but all other beings might be purified and liberated. Then, just as you've done before, rest as awareness, simple being like open space. After a while, imagine, feel a source of pure, brilliant white light shining in the space above your head, the color of fresh snow in intense sunlight. Once you have a fairly strong sense of that light, imagine that it begins to pour down in liquid form, pure, brilliant, liquid light, a sort of enlightenment nectar, and it enters through the top of your head. From there, it gradually fills your whole body, pervading all your tissues, all the way down to the atomic level. As it does so, it starts to loosen up the stubborn substance of your obscurations or defilements, which you might imagine as thick sludge, noxious smoke, black soot, creepy crawly vermin, whatever icky form embodies the way your particular emotional ickiness feels. As the liquid light loosens this stuff up, it continues to pour into you till it fills you to the brim. Now it starts to work like a liquid trash compactor, pushing from top to bottom, forcing all the sludge or vermin out into a space far beneath you, where it's finally neutralized and dissolved. As this is going on, you may feel some strong emotional or energetic aspect of the clearing process. That's fine. Just let it all happen. Stay with the process till you feel completely cleared out, as translucent as glass and empty as space, and then, once again, rest as empty awareness. After a while, ease out of meditation extra slowly. You may have gone through some heavy catharsis, so really take your time coming out. Lie down if you feel to do so. Stretch. Perhaps have a drink of water. That's the basic process. If something in this speaks to you, give it a test drive. See what happens. You may feel to do this once in a while or to make it a regular part of your meditation practice, at least for now, for as long as it has juice for you. The pile driver. If you want to soup up the process, you can add the short version of the Vajrasattva mantra, Om Vajrasattva Hum. As you start picturing the light above your head, also start chanting the mantra over and over, vehemently, like a pile driver, and feel that the mantra is somehow driving the whole process. Have a sense that the mantra and the light are one, powerfully coursing through all the tissues of your body, pushing out and dissolving all the muck, purifying everything. Over time, if you find yourself so taken with this practice that you want to do it in the deluxe form, there are many Buddhist books and websites where you can learn the 100-syllable mantra, as well as a far more elaborate version of the visualization. You can also hear the long mantra at the end of this chapter. This Vajrasattva practice, in any of its forms, can be used as widely as you like, in any context calling for purification. In 2001, following the September 11th attacks, a highly revered lama organized a project to have meditators around the world chant a collective total of 1 billion repetitions of Om Vajrasattva Hum. In Tibetan tradition, it is said that when someone dies, especially someone who has been dedicated to awakening, the best way to help them along is to do the Vajrasattva practice on their behalf, to help them, as it were, clean out the old house they're vacating. By tradition, you would do 108 repetitions every day for 49 days, visualizing the brilliant light of Vajrasattva going through their body, and, at the end, seeing them as completely, translucently clear. To some people, this may sound a bit woo-woo, but Tibetan teachings generally have some shrewd psychology structured into them.